And welcome to the local news roundup on The Point. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. We're going to discuss most of the top local news stories of the week with some of our region's leading journalists. And Patrick Cassidy from the Cape Cod Times will be joining me on the phone. And Sam Houghton is here from the Mashpee Enterprise. We're going to speak with Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim DeRuda of the New Bedford Standard Times, Josh Bolling from the Nantucket Inquirer Mirror, and Ann Wood from the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll get them all on the phone. Lots to talk about today. Let's see if Patrick Cassidy is here with us. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for joining us and talking about the news of the week. Let's start with a story from this morning's paper in the Cape Cod Times. Falmouth Shelter is closing after not getting some state contract money that they depended upon.
Yeah, this is the Cape Cod Shelter and Domestic Violence Services, and they have more than just the shelter there, but they did open up this new shelter last April, and it is in Falmouth. But there was some surprise news for them this week. They found out essentially on Monday that they wouldn't get this state contract that they had applied for. They've had it for the last 10 years, and they had reapplied in January for the next 10-year stint, but they didn't get it. Interestingly enough, another domestic violence services organization on the Cape, Independence House, based in Hyannis, does appear to have won the award. And it looks like they'll be expanding their services and providing some more emergency rooms. We spoke to our reporter, Sean Driscoll, spoke to the interim executive director, Liz Rabideau, at the Cape Cod Shelter out of Falmouth. And she said, again, they were surprised and disappointed, but they are happy that the money is staying here on the Cape. That wasn't necessarily a sure thing. But they had just bought this home last year, so it seems like it was a little bit of a shock. And while the state says we're not closing down this shelter, essentially without this money, which is 43% of the budget for that shelter, they're going to have to close down the shelter. So the effect is the same, more or less.
Now, this is a shelter that typically they keep the address kind of secret because this is a place where women who have been in abusive relationships can go and kind of be safe from the alleged perpetrators?
Yeah, that's absolutely the point. And certainly keeping the address confidential is important. Again, they did buy this building last year,
right,
and it was relatively new, so I think it was a little bit of a shock that happened.
And if I remember right, wasn't there some turnover in the leadership at this shelter? Any indication that had something to do with the state's decision?
It's not clear that was part of it, but you're right. They did lose their executive director, Diane Pratt, very abruptly in October. She left the organization, and they also lost the shelter manager, who resigned at the same time. There were still some ongoing questions about exactly what happened there, but Rabideau said when she came on board, it didn't appear that had anything to do with kind of the application process for these funds. But you can't help but wonder if the state kind of looked at that turnover and looked at kind of the newness of this particular building. And again, the organization itself has been around for, I think, 23 years. So the organization isn't new, and it's also not going anywhere. They say they're going to continue to provide counseling and other services out of Falmouth, and they're going to still be there. It's just they're not going to have the shelter building, which is expected to close down by the end of June.
Okay. Let's talk about another location where people experiencing homelessness have the opportunity to go. This one is set to open. There's going to be another home for homeless in Hyannis, or at least that's the plan, but residents are opposing that right now.
Yeah, and there does appear to be some crossover here, only in the fact that Hyannis is kind of the hub for a lot of services, and that was one of the reasons that I think the state looked at Independence House for the women's shelter. They said it's Hyannis, it's the hub for services. People in Hyannis, however, look at things like homeless services and social services, and they're saying at this point that they've had enough. They have these services there, and they feel that they're saturated with them. One of these organizations, Homeless Not Hopeless, which is roundly praised for the work they do, they basically provide housing for people who were homeless in group settings, and it's kind of a transitional housing, hopefully, for them as they move into more permanent situations. But they get a lot of praise. The only thing is all of their homes are within, about a 2-mile radius in Hyannis. And the most recent one, which they've gone to purchase, is on Chase Street. And they're saying that the people in that area, the neighbors in that area, are saying that we've had enough. We have four of these homes in Hyannis, and having another one is going to be an additional burden. The fact is they'll still only have four because they're renting one of the other homes, and they say they're not going to rent that anymore.
Okay. Let's move on to Sam Houghton is here from the Mashpee Enterprise. It is town meeting time, and we're trying our best to cover town meetings. Can't cover everything that's happened in every town, of course. You should check your local newspaper and listen to WCAI in the mornings and, of course, and in the evenings during All Things Considered. But, Sam Houghton, you were at the Mashpee town meeting on Monday. A couple noteworthy articles we could kind of breeze through here?
Town meeting's coming up on Monday.
It's a preview of what's coming up on Monday?
Yeah, I just wanted to give people a word on what's going down. We have the big one is the Quashnet renovation project.
It's the elementary school in town?
Yeah, it's going to need... They're trying to put in new windows, a new roof, new soffit, new doors. Could cost the town something like $9 million over a 20-year bond. And town meeting, they need a 2/3 vote to execute what's called a debt exclusion, a fancy word for borrowing more money than they typically would in a budget cycle. And this comes at a time when on the warrant where there's a number of other infrastructure bonds and costs coming up. So it could be interesting to see how the town votes on that. Another interesting article, we have an old cemetery in Mashpee in the Lakewood Mashpee Pond area that has some ties to some of the actual original ministers and missionaries of Mashpee. So a real historic significance. The cemetery has been kind of neglected. A homeowners association currently owns it, but they don't really have any ties, and they have about $1,000 in back taxes that they don't want to pay. So they're hoping town meeting will take that cemetery over. They can properly maintain it and such.
The back taxes are related just to that land the cemetery is, so they're purposely not paying it, so maybe the town will just take it.
Right, that's the hope, right.
Okay.
Yeah, small parcel, but...
What's the phosphorus bylaw?
That is, so a couple years ago, the town passed a nitrogen control bylaw, basically... Don't use fertilizer near water bodies to prevent pollution of the waterways, and they're just going to add phosphorus to that. A lot of people are saying landscapers you don't need phosphorus to grow grass well. It's a pollutant. It's been hurting our ponds for a long time, so mm-hmm. they're going to add that to the list of things not to use.
What's the latest on? Let's move on from town meeting, which of course, as you said, is coming up on Monday. What's the latest on the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe as they continue their quest to get a casino in Taunton? That land where that was supposed to plan to go, I think they've already had shovels in the ground, is supposedly in federal,
right.
It's a protected
land and trust.
Federal trust.
Right. So this lawsuit's been going on, but the recent thing, we've heard that they are requesting a stay in the lawsuit, which basically means a delay. The significance here is that they heard from the federal government that they're going to rule on a very important part of the lawsuit, which is called a remand. It's kind of complex, not getting into the details here. Basically, when the tribe lost the initial round of this lawsuit, the judge gave them an opportunity to basically resubmit their application for land and trust. So coming up within about two months, the federal government's going to rule on that remand, which is going to have significant implications one way or another on the lawsuit. So I'm not 100% sure what those significant, what that's going to be, but one way or another, it's good or bad news for the tribe.
I guess that's true. Sam Houghton of the Mashpee Enterprise, thanks for filling us in on what's happening. Let's quickly go to the phone where Sarah Brown is joining us from the Vineyard Gazette newsroom. Hello,
good morning.
Sarah. Good morning to you. Let's continue to talk about the Wampanoag tribe, but this is a different Wampanoag tribe, the Gayhead Aquinna tribe on Martha's Vineyard, also seeking a gaming facility. And it looks like they're actually got some good news from the courts.
Yeah, they got good news, earlier this month with a 3-panel judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit ruling in their favor that they do have the right to build a casino on their land, which overturned earlier court decisions.
Is it a casino or a or a bingo parlor? I'm confused.
I think it's the terminology. Yeah, is tricky, but it's a gaming. It's called a Class 2 gaming facility, so it would be a bingo parlor.
Okay.
Yeah. So, so casino is used pretty loosely there.
Mm-hmm.
But they so that was a a big win for the tribe in their quest to turn this what they had planned to do, which is a building a community center that they're already building, and turning that into a gaming facility. But this week, and kind of there was another twist, which is that the state, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, joined the town of Aquinnah and a community group of taxpayers to challenge that ruling. That they're asking the three-judge panel to reconsider that that decision, or in lieu of that, asking for a full six-judge court to reconsider as well. So they're basically saying that they think the ruling, upsets the settlement agreement reached in the 1980s between, the Wampanoag tribe here and the state and the town, that it risks kind of upending that governing relationship and upsets big parts of the Settlement Act. So they're asking for a reconsideration.
Okay. Let's move on to another very hot issue on Martha's Vineyard, and that is moped rentals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this has been, just really a perpetual discussion, for a long time here, but especially recently in Oak Bluffs, where there was this formal complaint filed by a community group. And so this week there's kind of a new twist. In Oak Bluffs Town Council, Ron Rappaport issued his response to the complaint that was filed, I think, in January. And that complaint asked selectmen to declare the licenses of the three moped rental companies in Oak Bluffs null and void, and three of the four rental companies on the vineyard are in Oak Bluffs, so this is kind of why it's really centering there.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing he said is there's, really no way for the town right now to ban moped rentals altogether. That would violate state law.
Right.
And that's been proven in the courts before. But what the town could do is file a home rule petition with the legislature, which is a way for, towns to expand their own governing authority. And, this would have to be approved by both the state legislature and Oak Bluffs voters, so it wouldn't necessarily be a quick or easy process. But he said this is the way for the town to go forward if they do want to ban moped rentals in town. And there were non-binding referendums on the ballot in all five vineyard towns that have had town elections so far, asking whether moped rentals should be banned. And that was approved by all five towns, and pretty overwhelmingly in some cases. So there does seem to be some community will in favor of this. And Oak Bluffs selectmen agreed to consider this idea. So they haven't decided to go forward with this yet, but they are taking it under consideration.
Interesting stuff. Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Patrick Cassidy is joining us by phone from the Cape Cod Times. He'll be with us. We also expect to speak with Tim Wood and Jim Deruta. Jim's with the New Bedford Standard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle when we get back. Welcome back to the local news roundup on The Point here on WCAI. I'm your host, Sean Corcoran. With me on the phone is Patrick Cassidy. He's the news editor of the Cape Cod Times. Hello, Patrick.
Hi.
Let's talk about another story from today's paper that is a ruling related to a wind turbine in Falmouth, right near the wastewater treatment plant. I think it's called Wind One.
Yes, it is. And obviously, we've been talking about these wind turbines at the treatment plant for quite a long time, ever since they went in 2010.
Yeah.
The town of Falmouth won this particular lawsuit, and there are a number of lawsuits out there surrounding these turbines. In Barnstable Superior Court yesterday, a jury ruled in favor of the town, which had been sued by some neighbors, the Andersons, who complained, along with a lot of other neighbors, about the operation of the two turbines at the treatment facility and physical ailments that they said were occurring to them because of the operation of those turbines. And this, they were focused on Wind One. The jury, however, found that there was no nuisance connected with these turbines as far as they were concerned, and didn't award any damages to the Anderson. But as I said, this is one of nine cases in total. There are eight other cases, including three other nuisance cases involved, and a case where the town is actually, in a fight with itself. The town of Falmouth is in a fight with its Zoning Board of Appeals and Land Court in Boston. So the other aspect of this is Wind One can't just start up again at this point because of that case in particular in Land Court. It still has to remain shut down. This all goes back to a permit question as to whether the town needed a permit to erect these turbines, and the town building commissioner, I believe at the time, didn't believe that they did. And so they went forward without these permits when they were built, which I think gave neighbors and avenues to appeal in various ways. And one way was through the Zoning Board of Appeals. And again, that's ongoing and pending, as well as seven other cases.
I'm sure we'll be talking about those going forward. Let's go to the phone where Tim Wood is joining us from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Hello, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Report out of Monomoy about the regional school there, of course, about the number of homeless students. I guess the school committee was interested in finding out, you know, how many of our students are dealing with homelessness right now.
That's exactly right. School committee member Donna Richardson had asked superintendent of school Scott Carpenter to look into that. And he came back with a report which seemed to take everybody by surprise, really. Mostly, I suspect, because homelessness is not something that comes up very often here in Chatham and Harwich. But Carpenter said that during the school, this past school year, this current school year, 26 students in the Monomoy Regional District were technically considered homeless. And at present, right now, there are 17 students who continue to be classified as homeless. And at any one time during the school year, he said, anywhere between one and two dozen students may be homeless at any one time. Now, these students are students who meet a definition of homelessness that's spelled out in the federal McKinney-Vento Homeless Assistance Act, which means that they essentially they lack a fixed, regular, and adequate nighttime residence, according to that law. None of the Monomoy kids that Carpenter spoke of are living on the streets, so they're not homeless in that sense. Most, he said, are doubled up, which means that they're living in a home with another family, mm-hmm. most often a relative, a grandparent, pretty often here. Some are in foster care. Some are living in motels.
I thought that was interesting that foster care students are labeled as homeless.
If they're between permanent homes, apparently, they're considered homeless, which that I think that surprised a few people here, too. Carpenter said there are a few kids living in Nickerson State Park seasonally. But right now, he said, of those 17 students represent about 1.4% of the Monomoy student body. So it's not a huge number, but he said it does sort of reflect the socioeconomic situation that some families in this district face, specifically the high cost of housing around here. Mm-hmm. Now, under the law, the school is required to have a homeless education liaison, which they do have here. And interestingly, the school must also provide transportation to Monomoy students who find themselves in a situation where they're homeless but staying somewhere outside the district. In other words, if a Monomoy student finds themselves living in a shelter in Barnstable, the school has to provide transportation for that student to the Monomoy district. And right now, that's the situation with five kids in the district, according to Carpenter. Now, school committee chairman Brian Wittegren said he was kind of surprised by those numbers, and he asked Carpenter to provide a regular report to the school committee on the situation, and he kind of said that, you know, this is a matter that the whole community really should be concerned about.
These students who are homeless, do they retain anonymity, or are staff and I know some administrators at least are aware to provide support?
Yeah, well, the homeless liaison that the school has, who's the director of student services in the district, she obviously knows who these kids are. But I believe, you know, there was some criticism we received for running this article saying, you know, isn't this going to embarrass the kids or whatever? But none of their identities are revealed. I believe they're not even known, you know, by their teachers unless the situation requires it. We felt it was important to publicize this, though, to show that there is a situation in this area, despite the affluence that people see on the surface. You know, there's some people who are really struggling here.
Oh, I agree with the editorial decision 100%. Absolutely. Okay, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, thank you very much.
Thank you, Sean.
Okay, Patrick Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times is with me on the phone as well. Patrick, some employees, longtime employees, older employees of a hospital thrift shop received quite a surprise when they went to work. Was it last week or in recent weeks?
Yeah, I believe this was April 14th. This is interesting on a couple of levels. A lot of people think of thrift shops automatically as kind of more volunteer. But this is the Cape Cod Hospital Auxiliary Thrift Shop, which does have a number of volunteers, about 24, I believe. But it also has had these three employees who have been there for quite some time. And a couple of these employees, in any case, are older. One's an 83-year-old woman, and she's been there for, I think, a couple decades at this point. But the thrift shop helps raise money for the auxiliary, which helps raise money for the hospital and passes that money along to the hospital as a charity, essentially. But they were told, these three employees, that they fairly abruptly, it sounds like, from what the daughter of one of the employees told us and posted on Facebook, they were given about an hour and said they have to, you know, get their things and leave. The hospital says, speaking for the auxiliary and the thrift shop, says that this was a decision to kind of move towards that more volunteer model and basically make sure that the funds that are raised at the thrift shop go towards the actual programming and towards the hospital. The auxiliary has raised quite a bit of money, I think $8 million in 75-year history. So that's a lot of money that's going towards the hospital. But the daughter of one of these women started talking about this on social media, and a lot of people became very exercised about it and very upset. And I think it was the process that she was most concerned about, and that most people raised issues with. So we had reached out to various people who are on the board of the thrift shop and the auxiliary, and didn't get a response from them. The hospital seemed to, Cape Cod Healthcare, which runs Cape Cod Hospital and Falmouth Hospital, kind of stepped in and issued a statement about all the various good things that the auxiliary does for the hospital. And this decision, which they say is, again, going towards a kind of fully volunteer-type thrift shop.
Yeah, it's one of those stories you can get a little worked up about when you read it. I mean, an 83-year-old woman, been there, working there for many years, get out in an hour. It's a thrift shop. But
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
okay, well, we don't need to editorialize about it, I guess. But let's go to the phone. Jim, another line. Jim DeRuta is joining us from the New Bedford Standard-Times. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Sean.
Good morning to you. We seem to continue to talk about Westport and the farms there, and now we have another farmer in Westport having some problems.
Yeah, he's shown himself to have a couple regulation discrepancies.
From four pigs to about 100 pigs, I guess, is a discrepancy.
Yeah. So for background, we know that 6 years ago and then this past summer, on the same prop on a one single property, 70 acres, a tenant farm was being kept there, and deplorable, squalid conditions eventually led to the biggest animal cruelty case in the Northeast, with 1,400 animals taken care of and moved off, and the Attorney General eventually filing 151 charges against the owner of the property, plus about 20 of the people who were keeping animals there. So the town tried to reorganize the way it was doing its inspections and oversight of agriculture and animal husbandry. The state helped them with organization and resources. And apparently, one of the things they've come across now is a pig farm where the farm it's actually not a pig farm. I mean, it's supposed to be a natural cheese farm, and it is, and it has been since the late 40s. It's been selling natural cheese, but the farmer has a permit for 1 to 4 pigs, and he's got 50 to 100. There's little discrepancy. He says he has about 50, and state agricultural inspectors said they saw about 100. Hmm. What they found of concern, though, because now a quarantine's been put on the farm, they found a pig carcass there. The state was concerned about the contamination of all the food and even of the other animals that were on the property. So there's a quarantine there, and the farmer's going to be going into the Board of Health this coming week. And I'm curious to see how this follows through, because the farmer's going in to ask for the permit for the higher level. And one of the Board of Health members says, yeah, as long as he keeps the animals healthy and fit, yeah, we should do it. So
we'll see what happens in Westport with the could-be-one-day-a-pig-farm already having pigs here. right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Jim DeRuda, New Bedford Standard Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's go quickly to Joshua Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Lots of news on Nantucket, Josh, right?
There certainly is. Busy week.
Busy week, and let's talk about that town-owned nursing home. Very unique, really. It's a unique thing to have a town own a nursing home at all. It's kind of, I think it's something that Nantucket's pretty proud of, but there's some uncertainty about its future now?
There is. In this day and age, it is rather unique. It was a much more common thing, you know, a few decades ago, probably, but right now Nantucket and perhaps Taunton, and it's a little unclear there, are the only communities in Massachusetts that have a municipal-run nursing home in any form, and Nantucket's is completely town-owned. But as anybody who's been reading the Inquirer and Mirror and following the website for a while knows, is that it came to a vote for a new nursing home at this April town meeting, and it failed pretty convincingly, an appropriation for $30 million to build a new nursing home. And when we looked at that, we decided that it certainly bore some more scrutiny to take a look at the history of the town of nursing home on Nantucket for the last 40 years or so, and try and see what might happen in the future. And the future does look a little uncertain. Town officials right now, they don't know if there's the political will or perhaps even the money to build a new town-owned nursing home. And that also then begs the question of what of the existing nursing home? It has been cited by the state for a number of violations in recent years, has been allowed to remain open, has about 35 or 40 residents. But a lot of work now needs to be done there, some work that is essential, some work that administrators had been putting off, hoping that a new facility would be approved and built. And that's going to have to be approved, and the money's going to have to be found to pay for that. So one of our reporters, Peter Sutters, did a in-depth, comprehensive story about pretty much the thoughts and feelings surrounding a town-owned nursing home on Nantucket going back to the mid-70s, and looking ahead a little bit about what might happen now. An interesting note, back in the early 80s when a new nursing home was approved, it only cost $1.6 million to build the current nursing home. Now it's going to cost $30 million to build a new nursing home.
Wow. All right, some enterprise reporting in the Inky Mirror. Let's talk about there's a trial coming up soon, a rape trial. People are paying close attention to this.
They are. Monday in Nantucket Superior Court, there'll be some motions, and Tuesday likely jury selection in the 2013 case. It's a New York City man is accused of kidnapping, assaulting, and raping a woman after he attacked her, allegedly attacked her, in the early morning hours of July 5th, 2013. And this is a case that we've been following for some time. An arrest was actually made only in 2016 following a successful DNA match with this New York City man, Jorge Adams Garcia. And his attorney had moved to have the trial moved off island for a change in venue. A judge denied that motion, said that he can get a fair trial here. His attorney said that he might not have a trial by jury of his peers given his ethnicity, and the judge actually did some research and said that Nantucket has a higher percentage of Hispanic population, Latino population, than the surrounding three counties. So that was an unsuccessful try. A couple of other motions had been filed earlier, including one that the judge did uphold, and that prohibits the alleged victim from publicly identifying her accuser in court because of some discrepancies and some issues with the way the photo array was presented to her by police. So it's going to be a difficult case, I think, moving forward, difficult for everyone involved, and it probably will likely start Wednesday in the Nantucket Superior Court.
Okay, and Daffodil Weekend coming up, that's a big deal.
It is a big deal. It's a big deal for the businesses on Nantucket in particular. It's sort of the first big, real big weekend of the season. Visitors have already started arriving. They start arriving Monday, Tuesday. There's a lot more here now. About 10,000 people expected this weekend for a flower show, an antique car parade, lots of events. It really sort of kicks off the spring season. It'll quiet down a little bit, and then before we really get rolling as the schools get out another month or so.
And our staff was on Nantucket this week for a pub night. It was nice to say hello to everybody. Well attended.
Very good.
All right, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Patrick Cassidy is joining me on the phone from the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, a very interesting story about a police sergeant here, leaving his gun in a restaurant, and he's been he's suspended with pay right now. This is paid leave right now, right?
Yes, it is, and this is going back to September, so it's a ways back, but we just found out about it recently. This is Sergeant Christopher Challies. He's, again, a 19-year veteran with the force. And by all accounts from the police department, when we talked to them, he's somebody with an exemplary record. He's never had any disciplinary issues. But back in September, he was at a Bourne restaurant where he had eaten breakfast, and he went into a bathroom and took off his loaded gun and put it on a paper towel dispenser. and then left and forgot about it. And what happened was, sometime later, a boy and his father came in, and they found the gun. Essentially, the boy found the gun, and his father, who was familiar with firearms, unloaded it, handed it over to restaurant staff. They contacted the Bourne Police Department. They traced the gun back to Chalice and the Barnstable Police Department, and that's where administration stepped in and talked to the sergeant. And they said that they found that there were some underlying issues, is how they phrased it, with him, and they decided to put him on administrative leave. Anytime that this type of thing happens, and you can imagine if you're somebody who carries a gun around all the time, and he was legally carrying the gun, he has a right to carry that gun in public. If you're doing that, I suppose it could happen. You like to think that you're going to be perfect and not leave a loaded firearm around, especially when a young boy may come into possession of that firearm. And that didn't happen. The father took it. But in any case, it does happen. And we talked to the Bourne chief of police, who said, you know, in most of these cases, we don't pursue the charge, which does exist, which is, you know, it's illegal to store or keep a firearm in a way where other people can get access to it. You have to, at home, lock it up, essentially. But he said that law is really intended for the home and doesn't necessarily apply to the kind of mistaken leaving it in public. But we talked to an attorney who has some familiarity with the law, Jason Guida, who is the former director of the Massachusetts Firearms Records Bureau. And he said, you don't have to prove intent, that he intentionally left the firearm out in the open. You just have to find that it happened in order to pursue these charges, and police pursue them all the time, although it doesn't seem like they pursue them quite as consistently with fellow police officers. So there were some questions that came up there. But again, it does seem like this is unfortunate in many respects. The sergeant, again, didn't have anything else on his record. And the police chief and deputy chief, who our reporter spoke to, basically, you know, talked about how it's a difficult job and you do see a lot of things that could cause you some problems and cause you to be, have these issues. It's unclear whether those, issues led directly to this mistakenly leaving this gun. But Chalice was at a fatal crash a couple days before the incident. And the police chief said there's an ongoing internal investigation. Now, it has been quite a while at this point, so we'll see when that comes out. But he says when that comes out, that will be made available to the public. But he continues to be on leave at this point, and again, paid leave for the time being.
Yeah, it's a well-reported story, and it does go into the what he might be dealing with a little bit. They don't say exactly what that is, but they are providing supports. But I was interested in something that you're indicating there too. 7 months this happened. 7 months ago, he's been on paid administrative leave, supposedly for 7 months, and then you ask for the internal affairs investigation report, which you're entitled to, the public is entitled to, when it's completed, and they're still doing it. 7 month investigation? That seems like a long time for someone who left. The facts seem pretty clear about what happened there.
It does, and again, I think the treatment may be at issue here. Again, whatever treatment he's receiving that they said that the department is providing for him. I think we've seen in cases like this in the past that the police departments have said the person's not available for us to talk to because they're somewhere else undergoing this treatment. It's not clear at all that that's the case here.
Okay.
And I think that is one of the questions. It has been a long time since the incident took place. And quite honestly, again, we found this out, asked the police department. They shared this information with us, but, you know, we wouldn't have necessarily known about it had we not asked them.
Understood. Okay, let's. We need to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with more local news stories to talk about. Welcome back to the Local News Roundup here on The Point on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. Patrick Cassidy is on the phone from the Cape Cod Times. Ann Wood is on the phone from the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Ann.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
Well, I was not in the host chair last week, but I understand that you spoke about a historic district committee member in Provincetown, someone who's been there for a long time, 12 years, I think, who is... the Selectmen are looking to remove her. I think we should follow up, and what's the latest on that story?
Yeah, so the Selectmen want to remove Marcine Marcoux, who's the vice chair of the town's Historic District Commission. Last week I talked about it because it was an agenda item and Marcine didn't even know why she was being brought up again on these charges and wanted to be removed. And on Monday of this week, they had it as a secret session, executive session item, her removal. She, because it was about her, got to open it up to the public and did. Mm. About 20 of her supporters came and were totally disgusted by what happened there. All emotions were running high. Selectman Eric Yingling, who really wants Marcou out, was smirking the entire time that her husband, Clarence Walker, was trying to defend her. They were using Clarence Walker's blog to it's a shout-out blog that has anonymous hateful statements that are posted on a lot to referred to her and that blog at the same time. And her husband, Clarence Walker, was angry, saying that, you know, you can't use my blog to conflate that winding in town. Other people were upset when Selectman Raphael Richter said that she had a tonality and attitude problem. Lori Del Milano said that, you know, a man wouldn't be brought up for this, that she's a woman who stands up for things that are right and gets in trouble for that. And if there was a man saying the same thing, he wouldn't be chastised and he would not be brought in front of the Board of Selectmen. Now, the weird thing is, really, only two selectmen voted to remove her. Selectmen Tom Dunnigan and Eric Yingling, who often vote together, wanted to start the process of removing her from the commission, while Raphael Richter abstained because he said there was a lack of written complaints, and Selectman Bobby Anthony, a candidate for re-election, on Tuesday recused himself due to a conflict of interest. Only Selectman Sharon Andrews voted against the removal. So it was only two selectmen are having this happen. So they're going to draw a letter of intent for her removal. Marcou, who's hired attorney Edward Patton to represent her, will have 14 days to appeal, after which there'll be a public hearing.
Okay, I know.
But it was madness that night.
It sounds wild. We know Marcine Marcou here at WCAI. She used to do some essays for the station, and I know that she's well-known around town, so I imagine people are paying close attention to this story.
Yeah, and she's been on the board for 12 years. I know her pretty well. She's a nice lady. She's definitely outspoken, but, you know, that's what we are like here in Provincetown. So I think two of the selectmen think that a lot of it has to do with the way she's treated some staff, possibly the town planner, although we don't have that confirmed, and some other people. But it's unfortunate because we have a really hard time filling boards here with people who have enough time and want to volunteer to be on them. So we'll keep following this story.
Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner, thank you very much.
Take care.
Patrick Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times. Patrick, another drinking water well, taken offline in this one in Falmouth. We had one in Mashpee a few weeks ago. Perchlorate, right? That's what they're finding in the water?
That is. It's the fresh pond well off Carriage Shop Road, and they found basically parts per billion of this perchlorate that exceeded the minimum or the maximum contaminant level for the state, basically, and so they took the well offline. They say they have plenty of water. People don't need to be boiling their water because of this or anything like that. But it is another instance of another set of wells. It's kind of hard to believe in 2017 that we keep finding this type of contamination. As you mentioned, Mashpee recently and Hyannis, there was perfluorinated compounds that were found there, PFOS and PFAS. Mm-hmm. And that typically comes from firefighting foam. In this case, they say the perchlorate will come from areas where there's a lot of fireworks or blasting agents or other kind of industrial products. But it's not clear where this particular contamination came from. The well's been offline since April 14th. And they're going to keep kind of testing it and seeing what's going on there. Hmm. But again, the pond itself, which is nearby, they say they have tested that, and that doesn't appear to be contaminated at this point. But another concern for another community in terms of their drinking water and kind of what's in it.
Sure, and they don't know exactly where it's coming from, but of course the obvious place to look would be the military base, where they have the largest groundwater cleanup in the history of the American military going on.
Yeah, and you can look around at these various contamination sites and see something like that kind of near most of them. Again, Mashpee and Falmouth have the military base out there. Hyannis, they have the airport and a fire training academy.
Right.
Even, again, out in Eastham where they had an issue with 1,4-dioxane and things in water, well water there. There was the land, the dump, basically. So you can usually find something kind of big around that you can start to look at and examine as the source. But yeah, there's a lot of different things that are being seen in the water. And again, some of these things are things that they're looking at for the first time, emerging contaminants, they're calling them. So we'll see how it plays out in Falmouth in any case.
Okay, let's go to the phone where George Brennan is joining us from the Martha's Vineyard Times newsroom. Hello, George.
Good morning, Sean. How are you?
Well, thank you. Chilmark had a vote around wine and beer licenses in town, and what's the result?
You know, this is a really big deal. 276 voters showed up at the community center to vote at town meeting, and just for some context, only 147 people showed up a couple days later for the town election. So this was a big deal, and probably the biggest thing on that town meeting warrant was whether to serve beer and wine in local restaurants. And in the end, Chilmark voters decided to keep the town dry. It's not entirely accurate because you can bring your own bottle to the restaurants in town, but they don't want its beer and wine served. They don't think it adds to the town. And in fact, many people got up and made impassioned comments saying that they wanted to keep the character of Chilmark the way it is, and that's why many people live there. And so it didn't pass, and it was a significant vote.
Let's move on quickly to another story. This is looking ahead. An assistant district attorney for the Cape and Islands is facing a disciplinary hearing coming up related to some trials on Martha's Vineyard. I know there's kind of a lot to this, a lot of facts, so I encourage people to go to your website, mvtimes.com, to look at this story. But maybe you could kind of lay it out simply for us as best you can.
Yeah, so this is Assistant District Attorney Laura Marshard, and she's going before the Massachusetts Board of Bar Overseers next week. And put it in a nutshell, there's allegations of prosecutorial misconduct in some of the cases where she's prosecuted people, essentially not turning over facts that might have been beneficial to the defense. And it's important for a prosecutor to do that. Of course, she maintains that she did that, and District Attorney Michael O'Keefe did tell us that he stands firmly behind her and that she's looking forward to having her opportunity to be heard before the Board of Bar Overseers next week.
Right, and she was taken to task by the trial court judge for some of those things as well, which is how it has reached this point, I think.
That's right. It's interesting to have a judge call out a prosecutor in that way. And in my many years of reporting on courts, I've heard about a lot of defense attorneys being brought before the bar.
Yep.
But this is the first instance that I know of a prosecutor being brought before the bar on a complaint.
Okay. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thanks, George.
Thank you very much.
Patrick Cassidy of the Cape Cod Times. There's been a lot of talk about a senior center in the town of Falmouth, and they've talked about different locations. Now opponents are coming back and saying, well, let's look at another site, go back to a different site. What's the latest on the senior center in Falmouth?
Well, as you said, it's town meeting season. There's this senior center proposal in Falmouth. It's a $9.5 million senior center that they want to build at the Gus Canty Community Center property on Main Street. And this has been, years of debate as to where this senior center will go. And it's going to face its toughest test coming up at the May 16th election, where it needs to be approved at the ballot box. But this group is maybe more formal than it really is. This is town meeting member and a couple other people are saying that this isn't the right place for it. This is an argument that's gone back and forth. There was a discussion about putting it at the high school, and there were a lot of concerns raised there by high school students and people who said that the high school actually needs more athletic fields, and doing this would crimp that effort. So instead, the town looked around and found this spot between basically Gus Canty and the police station and near the football field in the middle of town, and said they wanted to put a two-story building there. Again, this group is going to be pretty active, it sounds like, in trying to get people to come out and say no. Some of this goes to actually pickleball, which is, something I didn't know about, 4 years ago, but has become quite a topic of conversation around here on the Cape. It's like a kind of table tennis, but at this, you're on a court, and a lot of people are enjoying that sport. And they wanted, some of the people wanted to have a gym in the senior center for pickleball specifically. The argument is that Gus Caney does have a gym, and there's corridors connecting the two that will connect the two facilities. So that would be taken care of. But they said, we actually want a single-story facility at the high school. That's where we want it located. So, again, this group is going to be pushing really hard, making phone calls. They're going to be putting up signs. It's probably going to be pretty contentious as far as they're concerned leading up to the election.
And like I said in town meeting, it's hard to get to everything, but I do know that Truro voters this this week, I believe, $465,000 override. That's pretty significant on the Cape, a few other projects they had going on there.
Yeah, especially for a small town. Yeah. And this will go to a variety of different things, including an IT person, school expenses. One of the other things that came up in Truro, just to mention it quickly, was the approval of a zoning amendment that two zoning amendments, one that will allow homeowners to build single-family, single-dwelling units on their home, which is supposed to allow them to provide more housing for year-round folks out there, and that's one of the stipulations. It has to be year-round. It can't be kind of something you rent out on Airbnb or seasonal. And another one where they actually restricted the size of homes in the seashore, and this has been something they've been talking about for a while, and say their neighboring towns already do. It's a restriction. It's certainly a restriction to a size that wouldn't be a problem for me. 3,600 square feet on a 3-acre lot would be all you could kind of size it up to. You could get another 1,000 square feet with a special permit. But again, between the override and those decisions, it was basically a pretty big town meeting for Truro, which is the Cape's smallest town.
And a big week for science, and we'll talk about a March for Science that happened this week in a moment, but a couple research-related stories to talk about first. Researchers are looking at why we have such a large number of these whales that show up in Cape Cod Bay every year, and, you know, it's all about the food, I guess, is what the story says.
Yeah, I really love this story on a number of fronts. First of all, Marianne Bragg, the reporter, equated what North Atlantic right whale, these are the endangered whales that are coming to Cape Cod Bay in large numbers because of the zooplankton there, and it's kind of the thickest amount of that resource that has been seen in decades, according to researchers. But she equated it to them needing the caloric equivalent of 3,000 Big Macs. And as a fan of both Big Macs and whales, I like that analogy. So that's a lot of food that they need in a day, basically. And so there's this really thick concentration of these organisms. They're zooplankton. They're a small crustacean in the bay. And so that's why you're seeing hundreds of these whales. There's only 524-some-odd whales of the North Atlantic right whales in the world. But you're also seeing other whales, humpbacks and sei whales and even bowheads, which are not frequent visitors to our area coming to Cape Cod Bay for this food concentration. A lot of other things connected to this, including the fact that they're going to limit the placement of gear, fixed line gear. This is lobster traps and everything for another week.
Yep.
Because they're worried about the whales in that area, the right whales in particular. And there's also some research that's come out about humpback whales and the fact that ship strikes are more common than people were really thinking, and they've found 41 dead humpback whales over the last year and a half or so, or maybe a little less than that, 15 months or so, and that's a real spike in the number of humpback deaths, and they're trying to figure out why. One of the things they've found by necropsying these animals is that a lot of them had suffered from ship strikes. So
right.
This combination of the food resource moving around potentially and showing up in areas where it wasn't, the whales moving around to follow the food, and then ships and man-made obstacles out there for them could cause a real problem for the different species. There are a lot more humpback whales than the North Atlantic right whales in the ocean, but it's still something that they're concerned about.
I think we have to leave it at that, Patrick, but there was coverage of the local March for Science in the Cape Cod Times this week, and I know you sent a reporter down to Washington to cover local people down there, so I encourage people to go to the Cape Cod Times website to see those stories. Patrick Cassidy, thanks very much.
Thanks, Sean.
And thanks to Sam Houghton of the Mashpee Enterprise, Sarah Brown of the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Jim Drew of the New Bedford Standard Times, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Ann Wood of the Provincetown Banner, and George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And thank you for listening.